The White Album by Marco Lindros. My body rejected the calling card of death my mind had so desperately reached for. Shrouded in cold sheets, I woke up in a bleak hotel room, an empty pill bottle on the nightstand, and dried vomit by the side of the bed. At the bottom of the paused TV screen, the date display showed a mysterious shift in time. The same way you think you've slept poorly. But the clock tells a different story. The day is already half gone, and the sun is at its zenith. Wiping the slate clean isn't easy. Drawing the black curtain over everything with a handful of sleeping pills and ceasing to exist is an absolute catastrophe for the body, and it doesn't surrender its right to be and to live that easily. Yet a single glance past the gates during that failed suicide attempt revealed a parallel dimension, one that rendered so many trivial desires completely meaningless. In this second try, life takes on deeper nuances. I remember wandering through the different stages of my own disaster before hanging a "Do Not Disturb" sign on the doorknob and opening the bottle of whiskey I'd brought along. Looking back, I guess I hadn't fully believed in my own courage since I'd chosen the cheapest whiskey to save money. I had, however, paid for the room two nights in advance and told the clerk at the front desk not to disturb me, claiming I was writing a novel where I'd forgotten the beginning, lost the plot, and hadn't a clue how it would end. He'd laughed and said he caught my drift. I'd be left in peace as long as I hung the sign facing the right way for the maids. I hadn't researched how these things are usually done. I figured half a bottle of strange sleeping pills, a miserable love life, and a swig of whiskey to wash down each pill would do the trick. Even though the job didn't get done, I didn't regret the attempt. It proved that I really had been in love with Lena, even if her image was no longer as vivid in my consciousness, resembling a ghost wandering through my brain cells rather than the great love of my life. Love is a chemical state that tortures the body, changing from one moment to the next, even if the target and the sufferer remain the same. In the grip of lust, a woman is beautiful and desirable, and there is no flaw the mind cannot lie away from her essence. Afterward, it magnifies the tiniest mole into a wart, looking for any reason to recoil and disgust itself out of the relationship. With Lena, everything was different from the very first touch, when her small, soft fingers stroked away my sorrows with pure understanding. It was a love where even the pain was shared, and every touch felt like telepathic thought transference between us. Natural selection doesn't make mistakes. Now, Lena was dead. A week ago, she lay beside me, her body limp, her bald head on the pillow, and the plunger of the heroin syringe pressed all the way down in her arm. It stuck out of her flesh like a poorly thrown dart in a dartboard. She was smiling when she died. Lena had been in the final stage of cancer, and for a long time, she had been a mere shadow's breadth away from death. Delirious, her eyeballs bulging in her skeletal face, her lips melted into thin lines left slightly ajar, through which air moved in and out on its own, without the sound of breathing. A doctor I'd known since our university days had told me, when asked, that a hit of heroin was the best way to go because it worked instantly. And besides, that first hit of heroin was like ascending to heaven. How on earth did he know that? I bought the stuff from a dealer at Sergel's Torg, who was pacing back and forth with twitchy movements in an amphetamine cloud. He said he only used speed himself because heroin made you sleepy and was bad for business. As a commodity, though, it was perfect. The customer is hooked instantly. I didn't tell him why a stone-cold, sober guy like me wanted heroin. He asked if I was planning to kill someone, since I wanted 3 doses. I didn't answer. I just paid and slipped away. It would be Lena's first and last hit of heroin, which, alongside her morphine medication, would work instantly. We had weighed it over for weeks, and though I didn't want to let her go, I understood the kind of hell she was suffering through. The pain was only getting worse, and she refused to go back to the hospital. We'd had a massive argument with them to get her out, signing papers stating we took full responsibility for her predicted death in the coming weeks. We did, however, get a hospice nurse who came daily to change the nutrient and medication bags and the capsules for the morphine pump. Officially, we were in palliative care. We prepared carefully. We had practiced injecting, or rather dying, on a rag doll she'd had since she was a toddler. Maybe Lena died all over again every time we pushed the needle into the doll. It felt like some sinister voodoo, where every prick hurt us both. Lena often looked happy with the morphine pump in her hand, her skeletal fingers gently squeezing my arm. I didn't tell her I planned to follow her into the hereafter. I loved her endlessly, and every day was a treasure dug out of tissue paper. But as the pain gradually overrode the effects of the medical morphine, the inevitable moment to make the decision finally arrived. The syringe, filled days before, was within her reach in the nightstand drawer, inside a paper bag resting on her favorite book. Lena did it herself with cold composure, right after the nurse left. She didn't say a word while I nodded off in the armchair by the bed. Usually, I slept with one eye open, confident I'd hear if anything was happening, and I had resolved to stop her. The heroin-filled syringe was supposed to be there only for extreme, unremitting pain, a psychological mercy clause, or at least that's how I framed it to myself. I woke up and saw that her eyes had rolled back behind her lids. She was gone. I called for an ambulance, and while waiting, I tried to resuscitate her by pumping her chest, but she had permanently crossed the border with no return. There was nothing left to be done by the time the paramedics rushed in. The hospital requested a police investigation because the syringe was still sticking out of her arm. The hospital wanted to avoid liability for the unusual home care arrangement, and they didn't fully trust the legality of our agreement. Initially, I was suspected of mercy killing, and they were absolutely certain of some form of assisted suicide because the nurses' reports described Lena as weak and almost entirely immobile. I told the police exactly how things had played out, confessing that I knew of her intentions and that I had procured the heroin from an unidentified dealer. By law, I could have been charged with assistance or at least possession of narcotics, but the interrogator decided to let it slide. He saw that my grief and suffering were genuine, and a urine sample proved I wasn't a user. They did check the syringe for fingerprints, but I hadn't touched it even during the preparations. In the interrogation report, Lena's cause of death was recorded as a self-induced overdose with no further action, and the body was released to the family for cremation. I felt like I was in a movie where every frame was over-dramatized, and I was both the actor and the audience at the same time. After the interrogation, everything collapsed. I was rushed from the police station to the hospital and given an IV sedative. The next morning, they wrote me a prescription and escorted me to the exit, handing me a stack of pamphlets on dealing with the death of a loved one. They called Lena's mother, who lived in the same city. She knew instantly what it was about and had prepared for the worst. Everything would be done according to Lena's wishes, without any fuss. The body would be cremated, and on some summer morning, her ashes would be scattered into Mälaren from her favorite spot in the City Hall Park. It was all over, but I couldn't go back to our shared apartment. It belonged to Leena, and her parents put it up for sale. We hadn't been married or in an official cohabitation. Leena's father offered me the right to stay there for a year, but I politely declined. They packed up all my things and the few keepsakes I wanted from the apartment because I couldn't bring myself to cross the threshold. We grieved in our own separate ways, but I had been like a son to them, even though we never met again after the scattering of the ashes. After the funeral, I broke down completely. I couldn't continue my work as an IT specialist and private consultant. I lived off my savings. Staying in a hospice meant for the homeless. It was a restless place, even though staying there required weekly urine tests to prove you were clean. I didn't want to die there, so I went to a high-end hotel where I failed in my attempt. After that hotel night, despite my plans to move on, I stayed in Stockholm. There was a huge shortage of IT professionals, so I did temp work and acquired a rented apartment in a rather peculiar way. At a Friday night Finnish dance, I met a countess, a real one, though at first I didn't think she was anything more than a woman hunting for male company at a dance. As the night wore on, however, it turned out she was indeed a magnificent woman, half a century ripe, wallowing in her own fate as the last generation of a noble lineage ennobled by Gustav Vasa. A childless bohemian who, in her drunkenness, wanted more than just poetry from me. An instinctive feline who sensed the marks of destruction in me and felt a connection. The next morning, I was soaking in her bathroom, inside an ancient bathtub, resting on brass claw feet, listening to the Beatles' White Album through a speaker connected to an old reel-to-reel tape recorder. With my eyes closed, I randomly flipped through images, bubbling up to the surface of my mind, like a comic book. Blissful existential idleness, submerged in murky water, softened by stinging bath salts, playing at being a fetus, curling up in my mother's womb, sucking its thumb, knowing nothing yet of its dramatic birth or the life to come. Obladi, oblada. Despite the toll of 5 decades, Lisa de Lynn is still a stunning sight with her long black hair and soulful eyes. Wild honey pie, her skin always smells good, and I love the shy way she burrows into my embrace. Our lovemaking is slow and patient, until Lisa's small, rhythmic cries escaping from deep within her soul urge me to push harder, and I come on her pitch-black pubic hair. Sexy Sadie, what have you done? The Beatles were 20 years late or 100 years too early. Yes, I'm lonely, wanna die. If I ain't dead already, the magic is still there, and I dissolve into the associations brought by the music, losing track of my surroundings. Helter Skelter. Nothing in our brief relationship was a lie. I had moved out of the hospice and into her place, given my own room and my own keys. We come and go as we please without monitoring each other's movements. We also stay strictly away from each other's acquaintances. If she has guests, I slip out via the back stairs or hide in my room to read the classics I've hoarded there. Officially, I am her registered subtenant anyway, so no one questions my presence if I drift to the bathroom or the fridge. Sometimes grief still catches me off guard, and I'll disappear for days on end, crashing at the place of whatever temporary companion I find. Then I come home, a scruffy, foul-smelling wreck. The bathtub, the oversized headphones, the vintage Uhura Reporter tape recorder, and its sole remaining reel, the Beatles' White Album, bring me back to life. Sometimes I think relationships are like scenes in a revolving door, a brief moment in the same compartment, and then you walk your separate ways. After 6 months, the Beatles' White Album is worn to shreds, and it's time to vanish for good, I think to myself as I step out of the tub. Lisa stands on the expensive rug within the antique frame of the room, watching me dress. She smiles. We both know the tape has run out, my grief has become a memory, and there is nothing left between us. We share a long hug and would have fucked goodbye, but she has her period, so we just kiss, letting the touch convey our gratitude for the moments we shared. Then I go to my room, pack my few belongings into my backpack, the one with the padded laptop sleeve, leave my keys on the bedspread, and exit down the back stairs. I was already expected elsewhere. Cry, baby, cry. Make your mother sigh. She's old enough to know better. Cry, baby, cry.